Welcome to Friday. Welcome to The Week in Review. Right here on KUOW Seattle, we run down the big stuff of the week and figure out what it meant, why it matters. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm always happy when Knute Berger, the Mossback, is here from CrossCut.com and Seattle Magazine. Hey, Knute.
Happy to be here, Bill.
And Natalie Brand, too, political reporter with King 5 News. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
Rob McKenna used to be the Attorney General of Washington State. Good to see you again, Rob.
Happy St. Patrick's Day Eve.
Happy St. Patrick's Day Eve. Happy Pi Day. Happy Ides of March. On Wednesday morning of this week at 10 o'clock in the morning, students in Washington State joined their peers across the country and walked out of class. They were protesting gun violence in schools. Here is Ballard High School junior Jade Macer.
If our politicians will not act, then we will. I truly believe that our generation has the strength to change the gun control debate.
Jade walked out of Ballard High under the approving eyes of Governor Inslee.
Donald Trump might be afraid of the NRA, but the Ballard Beavers are not afraid of the NRA. I know that about Ballard Beavers.
Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin also walked with students. Natalie, why are our leaders not saying, "We agree with you, now stay in school"?
Well, I think that we are seeing a reaction, an uprising from students that we haven't seen following past tragedies, shooting tragedies and school shootings. This was a walkout and a movement that's being supported by a lot of our local Democratic leaders, by the schools themselves, and by a lot of members of the public, community members, who are still confused as to why Olympia lawmakers didn't act on more gun safety measures.
In Olympia. The bump stock ban passed.
But an enhanced background check. Mm-hmm. And a measure that would have increased the age of legal purchase of semi-automatic rifles from 18 to 21 did not pass, despite a Democratic-controlled state legislature. And I think there's also a lot of confusion in the public as to why we have different rules for different types of guns, handguns versus long guns. There's a difference in the age of purchase and a difference in the background checks required.
Rob McKenna, are these students right? A lot of them say, look at the polling on how people say they feel about gun control and look at the lack of action in Olympia and the system is broken.
Well, the system is broken in the sense that people who want certain change aren't getting it. But the system works in the sense that the more highly motivated a particular group is, the more influence they can have on elected officials. In this case, people who support gun rights are highly organized and highly motivated. The balance of power could be shifting. But then again, as you all have just pointed out, not much of substance happened in this year's legislative session. And that's because there are Democrats who are also leery of significant new gun control measures. That's also why you don't see more gun control measures pass in other states that have Democratic majorities.
Although I would point out that the Florida legislature, Republican controlled, did pass following Parkland a series of gun safety measures and bipartisan proposals that both dealt with school security and also raising the age to 21 to purchase rifles.
They're close to Parkland. It's completely understandable that it would happen there. Obviously, you have to hope doesn't take a tragedy in our own state for our own legislature to take steps. But in Florida, that seems to be what it took.
Now there's talk of a potential citizen initiative.
Yes, and there was a walkout at Marysville-Pilchuck, among other schools, this week where there was that shooting. Knute Berger, you've been watching all of this. What are you thinking?
What? I found the footage of the walkouts really inspiring. I think it's just great to see kids, in this case, as young as elementary school, but mostly high school, galvanized around an issue. Walkouts in and of themselves don't necessarily do anything except help mobilize people to further political action. And sometimes they galvanize politicians when they see the sort of strength of numbers and they hear the passionate arguments made by the proponents of gun control or whatever the issue might be. We've had, school walkouts have played a significant role in making change. And I'm thinking 50 years ago, we had one of the most significant school walkouts at Franklin High School, 1968. Protest over the treatment of African-American students at Franklin. It happened right before Martin Luther King's assassination. which then further kind of galvanized action. So you had the student advocacy combined with social unrest caused by a national tragedy, and things happened. Things moved. Seattle City Council had opposed the city of Seattle, a population of city of Seattle had opposed open housing. They'd voted it down almost 2-1. And within weeks of King's assassination and the unrest, that including student walkouts that occurred at that time, they suddenly passed it. And I think it was an important moment for the city. So I just find it, I find the young voices inspiring and admirable, and I hope it leads to something.
Republican Rob, did you have any problem with seeing students leaving class for in support of their beliefs?
Not particularly. I was, before we came on the air, I was talking about a protest that I helped lead in Bellevue back in the last century. But it was the first time there had been a student protest down Bellevue Way in anyone's recollection.
What got Rob McKenna out of his class?
It was a first. It was a First Amendment question, a First Amendment issue, because the school board had decided to ban all concerts in the high schools and in the middle schools in the month of December, because they were concerned that if the concerts were held in December, they might include music with religious overtones. Instead of just leaving it to the common sense of the choir directors and other music teachers to not perform Handel's Messiah, they just put a blanket rule in effect, and we thought that was we thought it was ridiculous and offensive, frankly.
So you started the war on Christmas.
Well, we were trying to protect the rights of teachers and students to use common sense to pick the right music. And we held a demonstration. It was during the school day, and it got a lot of attention, and none of us got in trouble. So I think, you know, in a case like this, students are within their rights under the First Amendment to go out and demonstrate about something they care about this passionately.
Not only that, but it's an educational opportunity, right?
True.
And listening to the students and watching them, they had prepared for this. They've been writing essays in some schools and talking to the students. They wrote speeches. They gave speeches. So this was definitely an educational experience for a lot of them. And to go back to the point about student walkouts making a difference in history, that was one thing that came up in interviews on Wednesday, that they were drawing parallels to other major movements in American history. This could has the potential to become one of those movements.
By the way, Rob, whatever happened to your walkout? Did you change the...
They didn't change the rule immediately, but sometime down the road, they did eliminate that policy. I know that because I've had four kids go through Bellevue schools, and they've all been in music, and they've all had concerts in December. So at some point after our rousing demonstration in 1980, they changed that policy.
By the way, if you watch the news and social media, you might think school shootings are this growing epidemic. So you might be surprised to hear this.
Schools are safer today than they have been in previous decades.
That's criminology professor James Allen Fox on NPR this week, saying that fewer kids are being shot and killed in schools now than a generation ago. And the number of mass school shootings has also been higher in the past.
There were more back in the 90s than in recent years. For example, in one school year in 1997-98, there were four multiple victim shootings in schools in one academic year.
One reason school shootings live large in our minds is that we can't tell ourselves we're immune from them. We can't say, well, I don't have a loaded gun in my closet. I don't deal drugs, but I just, you know, I just sent my kids to a public school and look what happened. So it's, that's one of the reasons. And you see the cell phone videos and, you know, social media and everything, but it's a bigger fear in our minds than maybe it is.
It's also unacceptable that you have incidents like Parkland. It was on, Sandy Hook was unacceptable as well. I mean, all these mass shootings are, but when schools are involved, they're particularly horrific. So even though statistically the schools are safer and the number of kids killed in shootings in school has dropped by about 2/3 since the early 90s on a per capita basis, that's like saying, well, it's acceptable to have two airplanes crash every year because airline travel is still the safest form of transportation. It's not. It's, when you have this many people die at one time, it just isn't. And so it's healthy to have a debate about the balance between rights and restrictions. And that's what's going on now.
I didn't have school shooting drills when I went to high school. I'm not that old, but, you know, that was not happening during my time in school. It is happening now. It's the reality of this generation.
And this gun violence researcher says that mass shootings are increasing social pressure to address the much bigger threat of small-scale shootings that mostly happen in private, so that if you wanted more gun control, then that fear wouldn't be a bad thing either.
Well, I think there's this feeling, part of it's the cumulative effect of nothing changing in the sense that you know, after Sandy Hook, there's a Parkland, you know, and that, that this is some kind of a standard that we ought to be able to adhere to. And it's not just people who are upset about the shootings and want gun control, but it's also the response of the current administration, for example, of saying they're kind of buying into the hysteria in terms of saying, well, all teachers should be armed, or, you know, there should be, you know, we should be more guns is the solution. And, you know, dealing, you know, we have going to have to deal with it very rationally. But I think that there's a cumulative effect. It's kind of like a landslide that gains momentum as it goes along in terms of people's awareness that it's a problem.
Final question, then we'll move on, but I want to circle back to the where we started, which was the walkout. So can students with unpopular opinions walk out of Seattle schools? If let's say they want to walk out, there's a group that wants to walk out in support of abortion, you know, laws against abortion or what have you. It's unpopular in Seattle, and they on social media they got their people in this school and that school and that school who agree with them. How would schools react to that? How would the mayor, the governor?
Well, the mayor and governor probably wouldn't show up for that demonstration against abortion rights.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they would.
Because it wouldn't rise to the governor level, but in the city of Seattle,
it would be a test of the no pun intended, the principles involved here, which you know would be: are you liberal in your thinking because as long as people agree with you, or is it only good to be liberal if people or if they do agree with you? So I think that would be a real test. It'd be interesting to see if some more conservative leaning students were to try that out.
And we've seen recent First Amendment cases of students fighting against a particular school over their First Amendment rights. And in a number of those cases, including a recent UW case, they've been successful in organizing their demonstrations and making a case.
Yeah.
To also demonstrate.
Yeah, that's true.
I think there's some unique aspects of this particular thing, one of which is that so much of it is centered on, say, school shootings, so that there was de facto and in many cases actual sanction by the teachers and the administration of the walkouts. So these weren't like walkouts where students are going against the authorities and marching down the street. At least by and large, that was the impression I got. I think as Rob said, you know, students have First Amendment rights. They can exercise those. And in a case like abortion or something like that, they might get more pushback, certainly locally.
Okay. Well, we'll see about, I guess it's not until next session that we'd have another state gun regulation come up. So it's
unless it
it's
comes
be
up
a
via initiative.
Via initiative.
The current AG hinted that could be coming.
Good point.
To be seen.
That has happened in Washington State. To be seen. We're going to continue with the Week in Review with Natalie Brand and Rob McKenna and Knute Berger in just a moment. It's KUOW's Week in Review with Rob McKenna, Knute Berger, Natalie Brand. I'm Bill Radke. This week, a Pennsylvania congressional district that voted for Trump flipped and elected a Democrat. Many pundits are forecasting a blue wave that will turn Congress from Republican to Democrat in this fall's midterm election. Would Washington State ride that wave? We have a Republican in Congress from our 8th district. Dave Reichert represents Issaquah to Auburn and out to Wenatchee, and he's leaving this fall. Will the 8th go Democratic, Knute Berger?
Well, unknown. I think it's an uphill fight. The Republicans have Dino Rossi running to fill the seat that Dave Reichert had. He's a known quantity. He did very well in at least one of his runs for governor. He's certainly well known in that district. The Democrats have a field of relatively unknown candidates. One will emerge. But this year, and pollster Stuart Elway has been doing consistent polling on this, Democrats do have the wind at their backs. Part of it is that usually the party that's out of power during a midterm picks up seats in Congress. President Trump's unpopularity, he's fairly unpopular in Washington, especially among Democrats, but also among independent voters. So the possibility of picking up the 8th is a real one, and possibly other districts in Washington.
How real, Natalie?
Well, I think Rob McKenna is also going to bring up this point, but there's a huge importance that in races that you have to pick the right candidate for the district. So Democrat or Republican, that candidate has to resonate with the voters in that district and also, you know, be, if it's a independent leaning district or Republican in the 8th district, it's always voted for Republican. It has to be a candidate who might have more moderate views and be able to pick up some of those independent votes or Republicans who don't like the Republican candidate.
So, Rob, you agree anti-Trump is not enough to for a Republican to lose that race?
Well, the, you know, Democrats will correctly point out that Trump failed to carry the 8th congressional district in 2016, but every other Republican running statewide on the ballot did carry it, including a fellow who was running for insurance commissioner who didn't campaign, didn't raise money, basically just paid the filing fee to put his name on the ballot. He got 54% of the vote in an election which Trump failed to carry in that district. Number two, Natalie's right. I think candidates matter. And in the Pennsylvania 18th district, I think the Republicans feel that a fairly weak candidate did not run a good campaign, who walked away from the Republican tax cut bill essentially as a campaign issue. So it does matter who the candidates are in these races. And Dino Rossi is a very strong candidate. Not only did he run statewide, as Knute pointed out, but he was a state senator in that in the 5th legislative district and is well known there for doing a good job as the Ways and Means chairman. So for some reason, the Democrats have failed to field a well-known name in that district, for example.
Who are the top names?
Well, I would say Pat Sullivan, who's a senior legislator, who I believe is in the district or right on the border. Contradict me, Natalie, if I'm wrong, but I think Pat is in the 8th. But they haven't put anybody up who is a known quantity other than, I think, an Issaquah City Council member.
There's a number of first-time candidates, a doctor, former prosecutor, some really impressive stories, but not necessarily known names. And just to give you some background on this particular race, I think more than a dozen Democrats initially filed. Now, some have dropped out, but we are just now getting into the phase where there's forums on the Democratic side, and these Democrats are on a stage debating each other. And so it's really only now that the differences between them are starting to come out. But again, going back to the importance of the candidate, I think another big piece is having a candidate who knows the district and who's connected to the community there. And I don't know if we, I mean, we'll have to see whether there's a Democrat who really connects with the community. But to go back to a recent state race, or not statewide, but state legislative, the 45th district, that was an example of a strong Democratic candidate who was able to flip LD 45. And, you know, she had deep roots in that community. Her children are in high school, and that made a difference.
So Anka Dingra.
So look, you know, wave elections do happen. President Clinton lost control of Congress. You know, President Bush lost control of Congress in his second term after making gains in during his first term midterm elections. President Obama lost control of Congress. Wave elections are real. But you can't predict every single race based on the potential for a wave. It just doesn't work that way. Number two, you have to look at the demographics of the district. The 45th LD has seen significant demographic shift that favors Democrats. Similarly, back in 94, the congressional district in eastern Washington that Tom Foley, the Speaker of the House, represented, also was undergoing a significant shift to become more conservative, which combined with a wave election cost him his seat. George Nethercutt defeated him in 94. And then the third factor is who are the individual candidates. So putting all of those together, the one thing that favors Democrats in the 8th would be the potential for a wave election. But the Republicans, you know, we have a strong candidate and we have a district which is maybe not as red as it once was, but looking at the 2016 results, still looks pretty darn red.
But do we think any other Republicans go Democrat in Washington State? Jamie Herrera Butler, Kathy McMorris Rogers, Dan Newhouse?
So, Kathy's being targeted. NPR has paid some attention to that.
But what are the odds? I just want to know what's going to happen.
You know, look, obviously I'm a partisan. I've known Kathy since she was in the state legislature. I have a lot of respect for her. I think she's going to be fine. She is up against a well-known commodity and former state senator Lisa Brown. There could be a wave of election. But I'm just not seeing the underlying shift in that congressional district that would support turning that seat over.
Okay.
So I totally agree with finding candidates. The Democrats need to find candidates that can compete in these districts. I think the result in the recent Pennsylvania congressional race, which was in a district that Trump had carried by 20 points, a Democrat won. And I think a couple things were revealed from that that are important for Democrats to pay attention to. One is continue to be a big tent party, a party that doesn't require a far left ideological unity. Find candidates who are known and fit their districts and can do well there potentially. The other thing is it demonstrated, the voter turnout demonstrated that Democratic areas turned out at a much higher rate than they had previously, which goes to polling here in Washington, showing that there's a lot of enthusiasm in this election, voter enthusiasm on the Democratic side. And the other lesson is that the Democrats will succeed by nationalizing local elections in Washington state, because Trump is very unpopular. So he makes a very poor running mate for Republicans.
But he's not as unpopular in eastern Washington, and in fact is quite popular in parts of eastern Washington.
Yeah, so well, that, but that he significantly either. Underperformed in Chelan County and some places within the 8th District. So, but it can be used to galvanize the Democrats.
Sure.
And Trump, when Trump tried to nationalize the election in Pennsylvania, it didn't work.
And we'll
in other words, he cannot nationalize. The Republicans cannot nationalize the election. So
I think it also depends if there's a number of apathetic Republican voters who don't turn out. And one other point I would just raise is the DNC is pouring extra resources into targeting some of these districts. So before we didn't necessarily see these organizing academies statewide in eastern Washington the way that we're seeing this year.
Okay, one more question. Who can tell me why is it that there's not a more but from Issaquah to Auburn to Wenatchee, why is there not a more prominent Democrat running for this flippable congressional seat?
I think it's that, and I look at Democrats who are elected in that area, they may not want to serve in Congress, which is an extremely rational decision to reach. It's a very tough job, and it's hard to get anything done. And they may not think that they can win it. And if you're gonna run for a job, you know, especially if you already are in a position of some prominence, like a senior legislator in the Democratic caucus in Olympia, you want to have a good feeling about winning. And if you don't think you can win, you're not going to give up something you already have, you know, in your hand.
Especially if so many Democrats filed in that race early on and the field on that side is so large.
Okay. And then finally, the 8th District seems weird to me because it crosses the Cascades. Is Issaquah, Auburn, Wenatchee, is that gerrymandering? Is that weird? Or is that seem...
Well,
like a perfectly normal
it was consciously created to be a Republican-leaning district.
Redistricted to become more Republican.
It
in
was.
Is that gerrymandering when you consciously create something to be one party's?
First of all, it's a pretty insult against Governor Gary. I just want to step. You know, the late great Massachusetts governor.
Uh-huh.
No, but seriously, I think that it was a political deal that was cut, which had to be cut between the Republicans and the Democrats on the redistricting committee, because we have a system in which you have to get three of the four partisans. So you have to get at least one member of the other party to vote for the map. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter who controls the legislature. The way our system works is you have two Republicans, two Democrats, a non-voting, non-partisan chair, and the system is set up to force bipartisan compromise. So what they did was they gave Adam Smith a very safe district, which has a very weird shape. If you look at it, it looks like kind of like a snake from Bellevue all the way down to still Federal Way south of there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they created a district safer for Reichert. And then they created one district, which was a genuine toss-up. That's the one that the first district, which Susan DelBene captured and continues to hold. But that was the deal. And it's still a better system of picking or designing districts than what most states have.
I agree.
Okay. No offense to snake owners there. I'm going to get a lot of mail about that. It's the Week in Review. We're going to get into what Seattle's mayor is up to. She's starting to show some more plans. And what right does a dog have to sit on your seat on a Metro bus. Stay tuned. You can tweet about snakes at KUOW. We are bringing you the Week in Review. Canute Berger, Natalie Brand, and Rob McKenna. This week, Seattle's Mayor Jenny Durkin outlined her plan to give 2 free years of community college tuition to all Seattle Public High School graduates. And I mean all. You don't have to show financial need. You don't have to get a minimum GPA. Don't have to be a citizen. Don't have to have a spotless legal record. Rob McKenna, any problem with that?
No.
Any of those things? Free college tuition? Thumbs up.
I think that it's a decision that Seattle is entitled to make.
Yeah.
Although I do, you know, I have a lot of concern about how fast the city budget is growing, you know, how many people have been hired. I'll never forget several months ago, last year, sitting opposite the table, and Mike McGinn was sitting in the seat that Skip is sitting in right now and was talking about how much Ed Murray had expanded the budget for the mayor's office and mm-hmm. how much spending had increased and how the answer to every question about a need was raise taxes, not reprioritize existing spending. So I think some of those priorities are fine. The free college tuition, I have some question about because I think that anything that's free is undervalued typically if it's a public good. But I do worry about community college getting out of reach for people who are trying to work, put themselves through school, and raise a family. So I think some help there is reasonable. But you have to start, it seems to me, by reprioritizing your current spending, not just automatically looking for higher taxes on people who are already paying pretty high taxes.
And we're going to talk about more about budget and overspending in just a moment. I just want to know anybody else, because I've heard some people say we should means test free community college tuition. Anyone agree or have any other observations about the Durkin plan?
Yeah, I just want to say that I think Mayor Durkin is being very smart here. One is this was a campaign idea. She's fulfilling a campaign promise. It was one of the kind of few original ideas that she brought forth in the campaign. I think the reasoning behind it, and I've talked to her a little bit about this at a forum, is her concern about affordability in Seattle, which is we need to get the people at the bottom end of the economic spectrum up into the lower middle end of the spectrum in further along in education so that they can actually get jobs, which then can help them afford to live in the city. Yeah. And that there's a kind of a massive retraining that needs to go on in the city to make it affordable for future generations. So I think it's part of a broader affordability initiative that I think is actually very smart.
And it's for the first 2 years, correct?
Right, two years.
I think it's a proposal that's been tried in other cities and other states, and I haven't looked at the data to see how it's worked there, but I think that other places have talked about success, and it'll be interesting to see the numbers. It's way too early to know until you see outcomes, and I think that in talking to Mayor Durkin shortly after she took office, she does plan to evaluate outcomes and see how different programs and policies are working.
And she doesn't need the city council, right? That's an executive move, do we know?
To do what? To revise the budget?
Free community college tuition.
Well, it has to be paid for. I assume what she's talking about is the city would step up and hand money over to the state to cover the cost of students attending community college. The community college system is a state, it's part of a state system, mm-hmm. and the state pays for it along with money that students pay in tuition. So they would have to come up with an agreement with the state to do that.
Okay. So yeah, they are working on the funding of it now. Can we tweet a link to the mayor's plan if our listeners want to know more? Join us on Twitter at KUOW. I have the link to the mayor's plan in there. So let's talk about these budget cuts, because Mayor Durkin told me this week that she's asking every one of her departments to submit a budget that's between 5% and 10% less than what they got last year. The mayor's office later told the Seattle Times that Durkin had misspoken, that the budget cuts would be between 2% and 5%.
Part of the problem is that we put in place new programs with one-time money. And so we've created these, you know, instead of having a dedicated revenue source for all the programs that we're doing, we have short-term revenue sources.
Are you frustrated with Mayor Murray for leaving you bills?
No, I think that we had a city that was on the rise and people and were trying to address real problems. But what I hear from more and more people is they're feeling tapped out. Our property taxes are high, our sales taxes are high, our B&O taxes are very high, and people want to give, but they feel like that they want to see progress and results from government.
And that was not Republican Rob McKenna. That was the mayor of Seattle, Jenny Durkin, just agreeing with one another there. Canute, any observation on the coming? She talked about a deficit being on the horizon.
Yeah, well, I think she's wise to plan for it. Murray also warned about a slowdown in the city makes so much of its revenue from growth, from the taxes that relate to the great development boom that we've had.
Which taxes are those?
Well, sales taxes, for one thing. Mm-hmm. And the I lost my train of thought.
Sorry.
You asked me a question.
I was thinking of us being addicted to growth because we need the taxes that come with growth.
Well, there's some truth in that. Oh. And anyway, I just think that the... I lost it again.
Okay, well, put that on pause. I'm sorry. I interrupted you. I derailed you like a streetcar, like a sounder line. So we're talking about the mayor saying we've got these short-term revenue sources instead of dedicated revenue sources.
It's something that when Mayor Burgess was briefly mayor, he would raise a lot. And even when he signed the final budget or reached an agreement before he left office, he said that this was going to become an issue in coming years, and it would require tough conversations between the mayor's office and city council. And we'll have to see with now I know we're going to talk about the proposal of a new employee head tax, how these things square.
Right. So I think what Mayor Burgess is referring to and what Mayor Durkin is alluding to is that today's spending is more expensive tomorrow. When you hire more people, they become more expensive over time because public employees are on salary schedules typically where they automatically move up a step in the salary range. And then if they get a promotion, they move up to a different range. And so as your workforce ages, people become a lot more expensive. And this is what we called when I was on the county council and chairing the budget committee at King County. We call it the bow wave effect. They worry about this in state government as well. So sometimes new spending is not that high, or new programs, new people are not that expensive at first. They become a lot more so later on. Secondly, it just makes sense to reprioritize on a regular basis because priorities do change, the priorities of the people and the priorities of the people running the city as well. So every organization, public or private, has to go through this process of reevaluating where the money's going. And given the amount of growth in the city budget, a 2-5% reduction seems extremely reasonable, particularly in an economy where inflation is running at around 2%.
Okay, so as my children become more expensive over time, I have a name for that now, bow wave. That's good. That's good. Okay, shall we talk about this head tax idea? Seattle's been considering it. It has considered and at least temporarily rejected the idea of an employee head tax on the companies with the higher gross receipts. Is that going to happen? Are we headed there this time around?
It didn't happen the first time around, and this seems to be, I haven't completely scrutinized the details, but it seems to be a more aggressive proposal than the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Yeah, I've heard they want to raise now $150 million from it, and before they were talking half that or so.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues is who does this apply to, how big a company? I mean, I think people feel somewhat comfortable about the idea of socking it to maybe large employers. And the question is, where do you draw the line? And Mayor Durkin and others are extremely concerned, and the small business community is extremely concerned that this will come down to affect a lot of mom and pop businesses, not just the big companies. And I think in a lot of ways it's an imperfect system, and the timing is interesting because if you're talking about a growth slowdown, if you're talking about cutting city expenditures, but then also raising significant tax on employers in town, you may be doing it at a time when you're about to see a kind of dip or slowdown in the growth and further accelerate that.
Yeah. I know a local company president who would pay this tax, and he told me that he has high gross receipts because he buys and sells a lot of stuff, but that doesn't mean he has big profits. And he says this head tax would be a body blow and that his biggest customers are not in Seattle. So it's not like he can pass his costs on like a restaurant can to the boomtime Seattle customers.
Yeah, it's another example of Seattle City Council talking out of both sides of its mouth. They criticize regressive tax structures, which is their stated rationale for an income tax. Then they turn around and pass regressive taxes, and they fail to reduce any existing regressive taxes. This head tax on employees is regressive in the sense that it's not related to how profitable a company is. It's related strictly to headcount.
Why don't they go by profit?
That's a good question. And here's another question. Why is it, if homelessness is the crisis they say it is, and I think it does qualify as a crisis, why are they funding it with the last dollars and not the first dollars? It doesn't make any sense. If it's a crisis, then take money that you already have and fund it. Make decisions about what you're not going to fund. And if you think those things remain critically important, then go out and ask for new revenue. Instead, they do it the other way around, hoping to capitalize on public sentiment around an important issue.
And it'll be interesting to see the weight of the business community because, as you mentioned, businesses, both small and large, are speaking up against this and opposing it, and have a lot of concerns, you know, and are facing difficult budget decisions of their own at a time when rent continues to increase. And a lot of businesses, you know, I spoke not too long ago to one local restaurant owner who was forced out of South Lake Union because she can't afford the rent there. And she calls the city unfriendly to small business.
Another example of that is the income tax. And of course, as you all know, I'm leading a group of plaintiffs challenging the income tax, and we knocked it out in Superior Court or headed to the appellate courts. But a lot of my clients, the plaintiffs in the suit that I brought, are small business owners, including Dina Levine, who owns an insurance agency. She points out that the income tax applies to the pass-through revenue that every S corporation, LLC, and other pass-through entity earns. And it's a lot higher in terms of how it's calculated than the B&O tax is.
By the way, just to wrap up, to bring those things together, the head tax, they're talking about the money going to increase shelters, safe zones for vehicles, more outreach to the homeless population, more permanent housing options, and rental assistance vouchers. That's the
all worthy ideas. In a what is the city budget now? Around $3 billion?
Well, we know that homeless spending increased significantly in the last budget. And, you know, they recently went through the rebidding process. So I don't know. There's a lot of questions about the math and the numbers. And from a political standpoint, this will be interesting to watch because I think one point that I failed to raise, the last time this was being discussed was right before the election of the mayor's race and a couple of council members. So, you know, they were more careful to take, you know, moderate positions on this. We'll see now if a non-election cycle changes the calculus here.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. The Seattle City Council could vote on a new employee head tax this spring. We'll see how that rolls out. And you're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. Back in a moment. It's The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This week we learned about a gender discrimination lawsuit against Microsoft. The company is being sued by three women, current and former engineering employees, who claim that women have lost out on promotions and pay because of systemic gender discrimination at Microsoft. And Natalie Brand, you've been looking into this. The company disputes that claim, right, and call some of the numbers here misleading.
Yeah, it's very early on in the court case, so we'll have to let this play out. I noticed yesterday that the suit against Microsoft is in Judge Robart's courtroom, which will be interesting to watch. He's the judge, of course, known for the Trump administration travel order ruling and also the consent decree. So I'm going to watch this case very closely. But
consent decree meaning the police reform order.
Right. Yeah. Sorry. Thank you. Mm-hmm. But I think it's interesting. It's an interesting discussion in the larger context of the Me Too movement and also pay equity discussions that are happening now across a variety of industries. A realization that pay still isn't equal between men and women. And this was even recognized passed by lawmakers in Olympia this past session, legislation that identifies that this is a problem and tries to take steps to make it easier for employees to negotiate higher salaries in the workplace.
For one thing, employees would be able to talk about what they make, which hadn't been the case before.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, it's not that it hadn't been the case before, but it's not something that is welcomed by HR departments or in private companies, right? You're very discreet about salary, and these are conversations that are not encouraged. And I think we've learned that knowledge is power when it comes to knowing what other colleagues are making who might be doing similar work at a similar level. And I think it's starting a really important conversation statewide and nationwide about what we can do to close the wage gap.
And Knut, you were saying this is extra important if you think about the tech economy as being the economy of our future.
Yeah, it is. I met with a bunch of Scandinavian diplomats last year.
And, don't we all?
Yeah, don't we all? And they had produced a book called The Nordic Ways, which was basically how to become a wonderful Scandinavian-like social democracy. But one of the key elements of it is true gender equality. Most of the prime ministers of the Scandinavian countries are women. Half or more of the people serving in the legislatures there are women. They have free daycare. Well, not free, but they have, you know, state-funded daycare. And they really police the wage issues. And so if you look at the tech companies, and if you look at the kind of social democracy that the Seattle City Council and others, people in Seattle, would like to create here, solving the problem with the tech companies in terms of how equal pay and sexual harassment and creating environments that are welcoming to both genders is pretty important to our future.
And trying to stop high turnover, because that's what we've also seen, particularly with tech companies. Not only are there fewer women working in those companies, but turnover is higher. And, you know, it's kind of a very higher level problem when we look at things like maternity leave and childcare issues. So, you know, this is a problem that's not going to be solved overnight, or it's going to take just a long series of, I think, awareness and changes to make a dent.
That's Natalie Brand with Rob McKenna and Knut Berger. I'm Bill Radke. The Week in Review is going to continue. We're going to talk about a species equity issue. Should a dog be able to sit on a Metro bus when humans are standing? And what do people in Seattle actually do when confronted with this controversy? Stay tuned. Now, on with the Week in Review. This week, we learned about doggy bottoms on your bus seat. Seattle Times reporter Paige Cornwell told me her experience of seeing a Metro bus rider put her little Yorkshire Terrier on the seat next to her.
And I thought, oh, that's kind of weird. You can put this dog in your purse. Like, why does it need its own seat?
Mm-hmm.
I assumed she was going to keep, or she would move it once more people got on the bus. And as we got closer to what I call the epicenter of Amazonia, right by that Whole Foods at Westlake and Denny, a ton more people got on. It was a completely full bus, and she didn't move the dog. The dog was just sitting there. There were people in the aisle glaring at her and at the dog, but no one did anything.
Yes, you called this the confluence of Seattle's love of dogs and Seattle's fear of conflict.
Exactly, exactly. And I guess I'm part of the problem. I should have said something, but I could hear people behind me saying, oh my gosh, why isn't she moving this dog? And people were looking angry.
People were looking angry. That's how we riot on Seattle buses. We attack you with our discontented demeanors.
I think we need to track down the dog owner and find out what happened? What was going on? Why didn't you put the dog on her lap?
Well, you're right. And the dog owner might say, nobody asked me. Yeah. No one seemed to mind because they didn't say anything.
Those glares, that hurt, man.
Yeah.
I feel that? It's like the Seattle freeze getting turned down to minus 32, you know.
This Paige was telling me about this because she wrote a piece in the Seattle Times about what the rules actually are and the fact that dogs are showing up more and more, especially near the offices of tech companies that let you bring your dog to work. And I got an email this week from a listener who said, just knowing that dogs are allowed to sit on the seats with their dirty little butts unshielded sickens me.
Have you seen some of the people riding the bus?
Yeah,
she's worried about the dogs.
Is there a health problem with your trousers touching seats that a dog's butt has touched? Is this a fear I've never had that I should have?
I'm sorry, Bill, does the word phobia mean anything to you?
Yes.
Of course, I'm a dog owner. I'm sure several of you are as well.
I don't have a dog.
It's also a sensitive week for dog owners and pet lovers regarding the United.
Oh, the United.
Terrible tragedy.
Oh, yes, yeah. The puppy in the overhead bin. Yeah, I hadn't even thought of that.
And that German Shepherd came back and didn't speak a word of Japanese. So yeah. I don't know what he was doing over there.
Yeah.
So weird. I think dogs on the seat, it's just fine. They are, you know, pets can be like children. But if there is someone standing in the aisle, a human friend standing in the aisle, let's put the dog on your lap.
I don't see it as any different than someone leaving their briefcase or backpack or purse on the seat and not giving it up for someone.
Well, this is a tactic. There's so many tactics people use to get people not to sit next to them on the bus. There's the,
speaking
the,
of phobias.
The guys that spread their legs, you know, and take up two
seats. The wide stance.
Wide stance, yes. And then, yeah, the backpack or the whatever. It's really annoying when, you know, people aren't courteous to each other on the bus and just assume that, you know, it's okay to let other people stand.
But what happened to asking? For example, I don't mind standing on a bus. I often do. And if it was just me and there had been a dog there and the dog looked comfortable, I don't even have dogs, but I just don't care. So isn't it up to me to ask if I want that seat?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I mean, or to suggest to the person that someone else might want that seat. Seating an elderly person, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's the lawyer in me coming out. But the interesting question for me is, if you get on and the dog's not a service animal and therefore you buy a ticket, I didn't even know that was an option, but apparently if it's a non-service animal, you get to buy a ticket for it.
Mm. Yes.
So does the dog or the dog's owner have a right to have the dog occupy a seat if they've bought
if
a ticket?
If they've bought
a fare. Yeah.
Yeah, this is the rule.
You'd think so, and there's no way to know.
Yeah, the service dogs can sit in a seat if available, but not emotional support, therapy, or comfort dogs. Non-service dogs have to be on leash, on the floor, or on the lap. Or you can buy an Orca card for your dog. True.
Oh.
Or you can tell the driver, I've got one card, but charge me twice because this is a passenger. And I guess you're right. If you've paid, then your dog is getting to sit on that seat.
Same with an airplane seat, although fortunately people don't stand in the aisles for an entire flight on an airplane. I think this also has something to do with the fact that we don't have enough bus capacity in this area. I see people left on the curb downtown when they're waiting for a bus and can't get on because it's jammed. And it's not that we don't underspend on transit. We spend a lot on transit, but we're working so hard to build rail that we haven't left enough money for rubber tire transit in the meantime to meet the demand. And people are really frustrated, hence the angry glares.
Yeah. Well, here's the part of the Seattle fear of conflict. Same email, the person says, dog owner organizations have such a strong political lobby. One puts one's social identity at risk by saying anything that could, in this town, be construed as the least bit restricting of dog owners' seemingly limitless entitlements. And I hear this more and more. Seattleites think it will cause them harm if someone disapproves of their opinion. We have a very, very snowflakey population.
That's why no one spoke up. But I think we need to do more investigating about what really happened on that bus.
Yes, I think you should interview the dog, Natalie. Get that dog on the air.
I would like to know. Okay, Yorkshire Terrier with a sweater owner, you're listening? Let us know. We all want to know
your
side of
the story. How did the dog feel about it?
It'll go viral.
Finally, quick note, the Seahawks have been getting rid of some of their most interesting players, Richard Sherman, Michael Bennett. I wondered, is this good news, Canute? You're a Seahawks fan. If the Seahawks can get better players for the money and improve, is this good news?
Oh, it's inevitable news. I hate to see these. Those are two of my favorite players. I hate to see them go. I hate to see the core of the team that won the Super Bowl break up. And we know watching the Mariners how difficult it can be when you have a great team full of stars like Griffey and whatnot. And then you can be decades before you ever get back. But I have confidence that the Seahawks will get their stuff together and but it's bittersweet.
Well, the dismantling is being memorialized in a new T-shirt. The shirt is midnight blue. It shows the Seahawks helmet made to look like the moon, and the message says, "Good night, boom." 2011 to 2017. Good night, boom, being a play on the classic children's book, Good Night, Moon. So this is how I would write that book. On the great green field, there was a legion of boom and a bunch of opponents facing their doom. There were superstars and fresh approaches, sometimes players yelling at coaches. Good night, Sherman. Good night, Bennett. Good night, critiques of the House and Senate. Good night, secondary. Good night, pass rush. Good night, Super Bowls full of mush. Good night, flashy. Good night, boom. Good night, tension in the locker room. Good luck, guys. Take care of yourselves. We hope you lose now. Love, the 12s. We should tuck the old Seahawks in. Nighty night.
How long did that take you? Did you whip it out in 5 minutes?
5 minutes. You know, it always does.
That was nicely done.
Copyright Bill Radcliffe.
I loved that book, by the way. Good Night Moon.
Right?
The original.
Yeah. The rabbits got to have clothes on and sleep in beds, but the cats had to play on the floor. Sure.
Strange universe.
We'll save that one for next week.
Indeed. Hey, thanks for being my Week in Review team. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Bill.
And thanks for listening. Good night, Week in Review. It's Natalie Brand, reporter with King 5 News, Knute Berger, the Mossback columnist at Crosscut.com and Seattle Magazine, Rob McKenna, former Attorney General of Washington State. I'm Bill Radke. Coming up on Monday, Bill Gates has a new favorite book of all time. He said that himself, favorite book of all time. It's Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress by Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker. Pinker says he understands why you might think that things are going to hell and that the vessel taking us there is a handbasket, but he says actually there's never been a better time to be alive on this planet. Steven Pinker on the next record, Monday at noon.